Google recently lost its spot as the most visited site on the internet to Facebook. The social networking site has over 500 million active users and is still growing. But discontent with Facebook is also growing. NPR's Laura Seidel wonders how long it will be before another kind of social network comes along.
It's hard to argue with a company that gets 1 in 4 page views on the internet. But Finn Brunton, a postdoctoral researcher at New York University, likes to argue.
Because Facebook is not smarter than all the rest of the programmers in the entire world. Somebody is going to come up with a workaround, or some kind of social structure is going to emerge that is going to need a new kind of system. But it's just a question of when and what form it's going to take.
Visit a college campus like Stanford University and you might find some clues about what it would take. Estella Marie Goh says her social media class did an exercise that changed the way she interacts with Facebook. The class played a game and projected everyone's Facebook profile on a big screen.
Their names were crossed off, and the people in the class had to guess whose profile was whose.
Suddenly, Goh realized she didn't like the way Facebook forced her to define herself with a list of interests.
They encourage you to basically just have these little headlines. I guess I want people to ask me more questions, not to just assume, oh, she likes The Office, so maybe she's this type. It wasn't holistic of who I am.
After the exercise, Goh erased most of her Facebook page. Goh says everyone in her class had a similar reaction. Many had other complaints, too. Stephanie Parker doesn't like that the default on her Facebook is to share everything with everyone. Her mom doesn't need to know about last night's dorm party.
Relatives or colleagues would be confused or ask questions about things that I'm posting just because they don't see that side of me in real life, and I have to explain it and or defend it in some cases.
Another student in the class, Suchao Song, says she's getting nervous about how much information Facebook has about her.
Everything is up there, right? You could look through an archive of all of my messages, all of my status updates, like every interaction I've had on Facebook.
Howard Rheingold, who teaches the social media class at Stanford, says he's noticed growing discomfort among his students.
When the first class began to not get into their graduate school or not get jobs because of their drunken Facebook pictures, people began to change their norms.
Student Estella Marie Goh checks her Facebook wall 10 times a day to see what other people have written on it in case she needs to erase someone's posting.
The wall, in a way, is controlled by other people. You don't have full control of it. And so if they write something that's not representative of yourself, I guess, people could read it in the time that you didn't check it.
So far, these fears don't appear to be cutting into Facebook's growth. Organized protest campaigns haven't enticed many people to shut down their accounts. But NYU's Finn Brunton believes it's early days for social networks.
I suspect that Facebook is definitely not the last form of social network that we see. And in many ways, we're going to look back at it as being the most primitive.
Brunton says he's seeing a lot of startups that are trying to solve the problems that Facebook creates or fails to address.
And the things that are going to come next, the things that are going to evolve out of this, are not just going to be much better at privacy and much better at data management. They're also going to be much better at allowing people to accurately represent the complexity of their lives and their relationships.
I mean, everybody doesn't need to know all your business. That's what a startup in a big empty loft in downtown San Francisco is trying to reflect.
Dave. Laura, nice to meet you, Dave. Yeah, definitely startup territory in here, huh?
Absolutely.
Leo Shimizu is one of the founders of Pipio. It lets users post real-time public updates to friends and strangers, but it also has very tight privacy controls.
So Facebook is about replicating your real-world social graph and connecting you to people. What we're about is replicating your real-world privacy graph.
Pipio has what Shimizu calls channels. Users can set up completely closed groups for sharing postings, photos, videos, and your mom doesn't have to see.
My mom would be considered a trusted source, but she may not necessarily need to get the post about me going out Friday night.
Shimizu would like Pipio to be the next Facebook in terms of growth, but he's got a lot of competitors, not to mention Facebook itself, which keeps adding functions like groups and email. And though many people may have problems with Facebook, it isn't that easy to just leave. Student Estella Marigo is also editor of the Stanford Yearbook, and she needs to use Facebook because everyone has an account.
And it's so easy to just send out messages for information that I need.
Facebook has the momentum. Almost everyone is there. But increasingly, people want the virtual world to mirror the subtleties of the real world. And if Facebook doesn't provide that, another company just might. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
For 7 years and in 75 separate interviews, author Laura Hillenbrand talked to the now 93-year-old Louis Zamperini about his extraordinary experiences during World War II. The interviews were always conducted long distance over the telephone, a fact Zamperini didn't think much about until he read an article about Hillenbrand. The article talked about her 2001 bestseller Seabiscuit and about the fact that Hillenbrand suffers from chronic fatigue syndrome, a condition so debilitating it's pretty much confined her for years to her row house in Washington, D.C. When Zamperini realized the effort it was taking for Hillenbrand to interview him, let alone write a book about him, he sent her one of his three purple hearts. Hillenbrand's book about Louis Zamperini is called Unbroken. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Laura Hillenbrand is shaping up to be the Woody Guthrie of contemporary narrative historians. It's not just that she has an affinity for singing the ballads of dark horses who, through tenacity, skill, and a lot of heart, turn themselves into folk legends. It's also that Hillenbrand has a gift for recovering the spirit of mid-20th century America. It's despair, sure, but also its humor and its graceful refusal to put on airs. Seabiscuit was an almost impossible act to follow. But as Hillenbrand says in the acknowledgments to her new book, Unbroken, she knew she had found her next subject when she spoke to a then octogenarian Louis Zamperini on the phone, and the wisecracking spirit of a bygone age came through loud and clear. "I'll be an easier subject than Seabiscuit," Zamperini told her, "because I can talk." He sure can and sure did in 7 years' worth of interviews with Hillenbrand. The tale Zamperini has to tell, augmented by mountains of diaries, letters, and official documents, is a stunner. In a nutshell, it goes like this. Zamperini was born in 1917, a son of working-class Italian immigrants who made a life for themselves in Torrance, California. Louis was a juvenile delinquent from the get-go, always stealing food from neighbors' houses and concocting homemade explosives. Louis's older brother saved him by forcing him to try out for track in high school. All those years of scampering from the cops turned out to be excellent training, and Louis eventually competed in the 1936 Olympics with Jesse Owens. Hitler even gave Louis a congratulatory nod. When World War II broke out, Louis joined the Air Corps as a lieutenant stationed in Hawaii, where he learned to operate the bomb sight on a B-24, an unwieldy plane known to flight crews as the Flying Coffin. His pilot, Russell Allen Phillips, known as Phil, was respected as a damn swell pilot by the other men, and Hillenbrand vividly describes a few knuckle-biting missions where Phil's skill nursed the injured bomber back to base, sans brakes or fuel. But Louis and Phil's luck ran out on Thursday, May 27, 1943, when on a rescue mission in the middle of the Pacific, an engine died, and their plane went down, killing all the crew on board but Louis, Phil, and the tail gunner, nicknamed Mac. For a record 47 days, the men floated on two, then one, rubber rafts. Sharks circled constantly, scraping their fins under the bottom of the rafts. Water came when it did from the skies. Food consisted of raw fish and a couple of unwary albatross that alighted on the rafts. They were strafed by a Japanese fighter and tossed around in a typhoon. The men lost half their body weight and drifted for some 2,000 miles on open water. Mac didn't make it. The other two men survived to become prisoners of the Japanese, subjected to starvation, torture, and slave labor. Because of his Olympic fame, Louis became the special target of a sadistic Japanese corporal who dedicated himself to shattering Louis's spirit. Hillenbrand writes here with authority and her distinctive sensual intensity. You smell the stink of the maggoty fish the prisoners of war were forced to eat. You feel the horror of the void on that raft. But Unbroken aims for something beyond vicarious secondhand suffering. Through the lens of Louis's story, Hillenbrand explores how people fight to preserve their essential selfhood, their dignity, in the most extreme circumstances. She describes how the prisoners of war fought back against their captors, stealing newspapers to find out war news, farting when they were forced to bow to the emperor. She gives ample space to the home front, too, the everyday courage of Louis's mother who refused to believe he was dead, his father and brother who schemed to buy a boat after the war and search every island in the Pacific until they found him. Louis Zamperini is still with us. He even ran with the torch at the Olympics in 1998 in Japan. He's lived on into an age where we're more skeptical about heroes. Inspiration is considered an attribute of middlebrow, popular literature, not the highbrow stuff. Maybe that's why, as I couldn't help but notice, the New York Times buried its review of Hillenbrand's moving and, yes, inspirational book deep in the middle of the Sunday Book Review. Don't let the cynics intimidate you. Louis' story and Hillenbrand's unforgettable new book deserve pride of place alongside the best works of literature that chart the complications and the hard-won triumphs of so-called ordinary Americans and their extraordinary time.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Let's follow up now on an economic success story in Africa. In a continent where we often hear about war and famine, we could stand to hear more about the small nation of Malawi. Harvests are up and hunger is down. That's thanks to a government program that passes out cut-rate sacks of seed and fertilizer to farmers. Some researchers think Malawi could do even better by reconsidering its dominant crop. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
Malawi is tucked into a corner of southeastern Africa. But when Sig Snap, an American agricultural scientist, arrived there in the early 1990s, she thought it looked pretty familiar.
It's a little like going to Iowa and that you see corn everywhere, up the hillsides, down the hillsides.
Corn, or maize, is the main source of food in Malawi and across much of eastern and southern Africa.
Maize is life, is a saying in Malawi.
But corn is a demanding crop. It needs lots of fertilizer, and that can be expensive. Also, plenty of water. And Snap says corn may provide calories to keep you alive, but it doesn't have everything your body needs.
Even with gains in maize, it is just a starch. Children, to grow healthy, need a bit of oil and protein.
In fact, about a third of the people in Malawi have experienced malnutrition severe enough to stunt their growth. Snap was working with an international agricultural research center at the time, and she started looking for ways that farmers could add something else to their fields and to their meals. She thought about crops like peas or beans or peanuts. They don't deliver as much grain as corn does, but they contain precious protein. What's more, these crops, called legumes, actually make nitrogen fertilizer from air and replenish the soil for the next corn crop. So for the last 10 years, Snap and some colleagues in Malawi have been working with farmers all over the country who are willing to use some of their land to plant other crops. They tried lots of legumes, pigeon peas, peanuts, even one that's more like a tree. The researchers wanted to know if those crops were practical for farmers to grow.
We had to see which ones were profitable, which ones took less labor. Farm families in Africa are really labor-strapped.
Last week, the researchers published their results in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Snap is now at Michigan State University. She says the experiment confirmed her hopes. Farmers who planted some legumes got that bonus crop, plus they got more corn from that land the next year because the legumes made the soil more fertile. Snap says farmers liked growing pigeon peas best. Women farmers, in particular, were happy to grow a more nutritious crop.
Now it's starting to snowball. 50-some villages, 8,000 farm families are now doing this, some with, you know, minimal connection to the project. In other words, we're not providing seeds anymore.
So, problem solved? Maybe not for most farmers, says David Rohrbach, an agricultural economist in the World Bank's office in Malawi. African farmers do grow legumes or vegetables when they can, he says. But in places like Malawi, many have so little land they're afraid to. Survival comes first.
They're almost forced to put most of their land into their primary staple food, such as corn.
Rohrbach says he's more optimistic about a different approach. Find ways to grow more corn on each acre. If farmers are confident they can grow more than enough corn, they'll be willing to spare some land for crops that provide a healthier diet. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Unhealthy foods often seem addictive. In fact, new research shows that sweet or fatty foods can act a lot like a drug in the brain. NPR's John Hamilton has that story.
If you've ever wondered why it's hard to stay on a diet, consider this observation from Ralph DeLeon, a brain scientist at Yale.
The motivation to take cocaine, in a case of a drug addict, is probably engaging similar circuits that the motivation to eat is in a hungry person.
DeLeon says that's what brain scientists have concluded after comparing studies of overeating with studies of drug addiction. He says those studies show that the wiring in our brains includes special pathways that make us feel good when we eat and really good when we eat sweet or fatty foods with lots of calories.
Drug addiction is really usurping or taking over, hijacking is what we usually say, some of these pathways that evolved to promote food intake for survival reasons.
DeLeon says that doesn't necessarily mean food is addictive the way cocaine is, but he says there's growing evidence that eating a lot of certain foods early in life can alter your brain. Teresa Reyes of the University of Pennsylvania showed that in an experiment with mice.
We gave mice a high-fat diet from the time that they were weaned until the time we studied them, which was at 20 weeks of age. And in that time, they gained significant amounts of weight and became obese.
Then Reyes and her team looked at the brain's pleasure centers, areas known to change in drug addiction.
And what we found is that in animals that were obese, there were really dramatic changes in these areas of the brain that participate in telling us how rewarding food is.
The changes made these areas less responsive to fatty foods. So an obese mouse would have to eat more fat than a typical mouse to get the same amount of pleasure. And Reyes says some of the changes didn't go away, even when the mice returned to a normal diet.
So it is similar to what happens in cases of chronic drug abuse. The reward circuitry changes in a similar way, and that promotes the seeking of that drug, or in our case, in seeking palatable food.
Reyes says that could help explain why obese children tend to remain that way as adults. More evidence of a link between food and drugs comes from a team that has been trying to understand how hunger can trigger an animal's craving for drugs.
Hungry animals will take a lot of drugs.
Uri Shalev is a researcher at Concordia University in Montreal. He and his colleagues studied rats that had learned to give themselves heroin by pressing a lever. When the scientists removed the heroin, the rats mostly stopped pressing the lever. But when the scientists also took away the rats' food, the lever pressing came back with a vengeance.
Even though they don't get the drug anymore, but they will go and they'll press the lever, and then this could be like hundreds of times.
Shalev's team thought this behavior might involve a substance in the brain called neuropeptide Y. It makes animals feel hungry. And sure enough, when hungry rats got a substance that blocks neuropeptide Y, they stopped pressing the lever. Plenty of other studies also have shown links between food and drugs. A Swedish team found that a stomach hormone called ghrelin could make rats seek sugar the way addicts seek drugs. And a team at the University of California, Santa Barbara, found that male rats chose sugar over small amounts of cocaine, while female rats did just the opposite. Even so, Ralph DeLeon from Yale says it's still not clear how far the food-drug comparison holds up, especially in people.
there's an ongoing argument in my field whether food's addictive or not. But something to keep in mind is whether it's addictive or not, there's probably components that are similar to addiction. And in the end, we probably have to use that information to try to deal with this problem.
De Leon says that almost certainly means focusing on eating behavior early in life. He says it also could mean taking approaches used to treat addiction and adapting them to overeating. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Millions of Americans have been getting by on unemployment checks that average $302.90 per week. Now, some people's checks are caught in a dispute in Congress.
Yesterday, the Senate failed to extend benefits for the long-term unemployed. People who have been out of work up to 99 weeks begin to lose the benefits just as the holiday season arrives.
In fact, more than 2 million people would collect their final checks between now and New Year's Day unless Congress works out a deal. People are caught in a partisan fight over how to pay for unemployment benefits, as NPR's David Wellner reports.
Congress decided last July to extend long-term unemployment insurance only until the end of November. November's now given way to December, and West Virginia Democratic Senator John D. Rockefeller IV laments that those benefits have run out just in time for the holiday season.
I feel terrible about it, particularly in West Virginia, where everybody's fighting to survive all the time. And we have to do it. While we haven't done it, I don't know.
The House has already tried once in the current lame duck session to extend the jobless benefits and failed. In the Senate, the number two Democrat is Dick Durbin. He appeared stricken yesterday when asked what that chamber planned to do about 2 million people losing their jobless benefits.
There's just no current plan or schedule for extending these benefits, and I think this is just wrong.
The expiring benefits were not even mentioned by Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell when he spoke of the meeting he and other congressional leaders had yesterday at the White House with President Obama.
And I think the one thing that we clearly agreed on is that first, we ought to resolve what the tax rates are going to be for the American people beginning next year.
Democrats say Republicans' insistence on extending expiring tax cuts for even the highest income levels shows a tone deafness to the plight of the unemployed. Again, number two Senate Democrat Durbin.
I don't know how we can sit down and talk about tax cuts for people who have jobs at the highest income categories and ignore the suffering and struggles of people who are unemployed through no fault of their own.
Why not bring it up next on the Senate floor?
Well, because we couldn't pass it. It needs to be part of a package to attract Republican votes. And we found the last time around, I think we had 2 Republican votes. That wouldn't be enough.
And the lift just got heavier for Senate Democrats with the swearing-in this week of Illinois Republican Mark Kirk. Asked whether he'd support extending the jobless benefits, Kirk took a stance most Republicans take.
If it's paid for by cutting other items in the budget, I will be a yes vote. If it's added to further debts of the United States, no.
Late in the day yesterday, Rhode Island Democrat Jack Reed defended his party's proposal to extend unemployment benefits for a year without cutting other items in the budget.
We've always done it on an emergency basis because it truly is an emergency. We haven't sought to offset it because we've always determined that it was necessary to get the money to the people who could use it, who needed it desperately. And we should do that again.
Reed then proposed the Senate take up the extension. Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown objected, even as he expressed sympathy to onlookers in the Senate gallery for those losing their benefits.
So make no mistake, I agree that they need help. But I look at it, are we going to do it from the bank account or are we going to put it on the credit card? Bank account, credit card. How about you folks up there? Bank account, credit card. Okay? I know what I want to do. I'll use the bank account.
Democrats, in turn, rejected Brown's proposal to cut other government funding to pay for more jobless benefits. Both sides say the solution may be to attach those benefits to a deal extending the Bush-era tax cuts. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Tomorrow night, the man formerly known as the Chosen One will return to Cleveland. NBA star LeBron James's new team, the Miami Heat, will face off against his old team, the Cavaliers. It'll be the first time since James's now infamous nationally televised decision to leave his hometown team and take his talents to South Beach. Needless to say, it won't be a warm welcome from Cavs fans who are still seething after they felt betrayed by James's departure. Joining us on the line to talk about that welcome is Cleveland Plain Dealer sports columnist Terry Pluto. Terry, welcome.
Hi.
So it's been about 5 months since the decision.
Mm-hmm.
How do Clevelanders feel about LeBron now?
I think Clevelanders feel about LeBron like anybody would feel about someone who needlessly rejected them in public. And a lot of people would have been unhappy with LeBron had he gone to Miami, you know, the normal way. In other words, you tell your old team the day before that you're leaving.
Right.
You just go down to Miami and you have your press conference. I don't know whoever wrote the line, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach, but that guy ought to be fired right away because, of course, it's just opened up all the other lines. You know, there's still a lot of hurt and a lot of anger because they felt he needlessly dumped on his hometown.
Mm. Now, I understand there's going to be extra security on hand at the arena tomorrow. I mean, you don't expect anything more than booing, do you?
No, I don't. But the thing is, if I own the Cavaliers, you got 20,562 fans there. It takes one nutcase to do something crazy. And you just don't want somebody throwing a drink on the court.
Right.
I hope they're smart enough not to hand out those little rubber basketballs into the stands, the Nerf ball type things. That could be asking for trouble because one person throws it, next thing you know, you got 500 of them bouncing off the court. And granted, it doesn't hurt anybody, but it just looks stupid for Cleveland.
Now, Terry, the Miami Heat, well, you know, with LeBron and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, were supposed to be unbeatable. They are coming into this game tomorrow night with a record barely above break even.
That breaks my heart.
Is there a sort of a healthy amount of Schadenfreude going on in the Cleveland area these days?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think people look at that Miami box score every day and they smile when they lose and. I think they look at the fact that LeBron's stats are down in just about every single area. And clearly, whenever you see LeBron being interviewed, you know, he's not having much fun at all. In fact, it seems like he's some guy trying to explain, you know, off some bad decision he just made, which, of course, we would say here that he did. I've known LeBron since he was 15 years old. That's the first time I interviewed him. And to me, it's just sad that a guy who really did rise up from, you know, very dire circumstances, made a tremendous reputation at home, doing a lot of good things, especially in the Akron area, that he becomes this vilified figure and that he didn't understand that this had a very good chance of happening.
I mean, do you think that Cleveland fans will ever forgive LeBron?
Probably the only way would be if some weird thing happens and 4 years from now he comes back and then they finally win a title with him. But otherwise, he'll always be the guy that turned his back on his hometown on ESPN in his own special.
Terry, the Cavs are not doing so well this year, and you have my sympathies.
Mm-hmm.
But do they stand a chance against Miami tomorrow night?
Sure, they do. Especially if the Heat play some of this dysfunctional basketball like they have in the past. I have no clue what's going to happen. I do know this: if the Cavs could keep it close, clearly the crowd is going to be very enthusiastic behind the home team. And that's one of the things that's been interesting to me watching the games. The fans here have embraced this sort of scrappy undermanned team that got stiffed by LeBron, and they cheer real hard for him. I think right now they're getting the big sympathy vote around here, and for good reason.
That's Cleveland Plain Dealer sports columnist Terry Pluto talking about LeBron James's return to Cleveland tomorrow night. Terry Pluto, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.